And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. I've been talking about the corruption that I've been dealing with. We've got a mayor who's been reelected. Supposed to be such a good boy, according to his mother. But he won't return the phone calls of a disabled veteran because he might have to deal with the fact that city officials take bribes from corrupt roofers. Well, there's enough disabled veterans in this area. I'm going to see if we can't get a more veteran-friendly mayor this next time. Rich Forrest is still in the hospital, as far as I know. There's been a power struggle among the relatives for who gets control of the money, so we'll see what comes of that. It's August 27th, the 239th day of the year. 126 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in history, in the year 410, the sacking of Rome by the Visigoths ends after 3 days. The most powerful city in the world up to that point was sacked by people who didn't know what baths were. 1172, Henry the Young King and Margaret of France are crowned Junior King and Queen of England. 1557, the Battle of St. Quentin results in Emmanuel Filbert becoming Duke of Savoy. 1593, Pierre Barriere failed in an attempt to assassinate Henry IV of France. 1689, the Treaty of Nerchinsk is signed by Russia and the Qing Empire. 1776, Battle of Long Island, in what's now Brooklyn, British forces under General William Howe defeat Americans under General George Washington. Put that under the category of you can't win them all. 1793, French Revolutionary War. City of Toulon revolts against the French Republic and admits the British and Spanish fleets to seize its port. This led to the siege of Toulon by French Revolutionary forces. 1798, Wolfe Tone's United Irish and French forces clash with the British Army in the Battle of Castle Bar. Part of the Irish Rebellion of 1798 results in the creation of the French Puppet Republic of Connacht. 1810, Napoleonic Wars. French Navy defeats the British Royal Navy, preventing them from taking the harbor of Grand Port on Ile-de-France. 1813, French Emperor Napoleon I defeats a larger force of Austrians, Russians, and Prussians at the Battle of Dresden. 1828, Brazil and Argentina recognize the sovereignty of Uruguay in the Treaty of Montevideo. 1832, Black Hawk, the leader of the Sauk tribe of Native Americans, surrenders to U.S. authorities. That ended the Black Hawk War. 1859, petroleum is discovered in Titusville, Pennsylvania. That leads to the world's first commercially successful oil well. 1881, the Georgia hurricane makes landfall near Savannah, Georgia. Caused over 700 deaths. 1883, eruption of Krakatoa. Four enormous explosions almost completely destroy the island of Krakatoa and cause years of climate change, which I'm sure the liberal left would have blamed on U.S. industry, when everybody knows climate change is caused by moose farts. 1893, the Sea Islands hurricane strikes the United States near Savannah, Georgia. Kills between 1 and 2,000 people. 1896, Anglo-Zanzibar War. Shortest war in world history. Lasted from 9:02 in the morning to 9:40 in the morning. Is between the United Kingdom and Zanzibar. 1914, World War I. Battle of Ytru. British rearguard action by Royal Munster Fusiliers during the Great Retreat. 1915. The attempted assassination of Bishop Patrick Heffern, Bishop of the Diocese of Winona, by Reverend Louis M. Leches. 1916. World War I. The Kingdom of Romania declares war on Austria-Hungary. Enters the war as one of the Allied nations. 1918. Mexican Revolution. Battle of Ambos Nogales. U.S. Army forces skirmish against Mexican Carlancistas in the only battle of World War I fought on American soil. 1922. That's one of those quick off-the-mark emails. The Revolutionary Fires of Venustiano Carranza from 1913 to 1914 and became the government army from 1914 until Carranza died in 1920. 1915, an insurgent group known as the Sedicionistas was formed and supported by the Carranistas. The title was first used, the Constitutionalist, by all anti-Huerta forces before the 1914 breakaway of Pancho Villa. That was following the defeat of Victoriano Huerta. Carranza, the first chief of the revolution, attracted talented generals to his faction, especially Alvaro Obregón. Obregón defeated Villa's División del Norte in the Battle of Sayana, ending Villa as a national force. And, of course, were somewhat German-guided at that point in time, and that's why it was considered a World War I battle. 1922, Greco-Turkish War. The Turkish army takes the Aegean city of Afyonkarahisar from the Kingdom of Greece. 1927, five Canadian women filed a petition to the Supreme Court of Canada asking, does the word persons in Section 24 of the British North American Act of 1867 include females? That was a very imaginative use of the law. 1928, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, outlawing wars, signed by 15 nations. Ultimately, 61 nations will sign it, and all of them ignored it, but it looked good. 1933, the first Afrikaans Bibles introduced during the Bible Festival in Bloemfontein. 1939, the first flight of the turbojet-powered Hinkle HE-178, the world's first jet aircraft, took place on this date. And had they been able to get it into production, we'd all be speaking German right now. 1942, first day of the Snarny Massacre, carried out by Germans and Ukrainians. And for those that are not familiar with it, it was an execution of an estimated 14 to 18,000 people, mostly Jews, in the Nazi-occupied city of Sarny. And now, Rivne Oblast of the Ukraine. It took place on August 27th and 28th, 1942. At that point in time, that city was part of Poland until 1939 when it was captured by Nazi Germany in 1941, following a German attack on the Soviet Union. It had a Jewish population between 5 and 7,000. Soviet forces who had occupied the city following the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact and the Soviet invasion of Poland in 1939 retreated pretty much without firing a shot. Ukrainian nationalists didn't retreat with the Soviets, but saw an opportunity to support the independence of Ukraine through alliances with the Nazis. Unfortunately, the Nazis double-crossed them. Okay, 1943, World War II. Japanese forces evacuate New Georgia Island, the Pacific Theater of Operations during World War II. 1943, World War II, aerial bombardment. Let's see. There we go. By the Luftwaffe, razes to the ground the village of Forizia in Crete. 1956, the nuclear power station at Calder Hall in the UK was connected to the national power grid, becoming the world's first commercial nuclear power station to generate electricity on an industrial scale. 1962, the Mariner 2 unmanned space mission is launched to Venus by NASA. 1963, an explosion at the Cain Creek potash mine in Moab, Utah, kills 18 miners. 1964, South Vietnamese junta leader Nguyen Khan enters into a triumvirate power-sharing agreement with rival generals Tran Kim and Durong Van Minh, who had both been involved in plots to unseat Khan. 1971, an attempted coup d'etat fails in the African nation of Chad. The government of Chad accuses Egypt of playing a role in the attempt and breaks off diplomatic relations. 1975, the governor of Portuguese Timor abandons its capital, Dili, and flees to Oturo Island, leaving control to a liberal group. Now, keep in mind, whenever these leaders flee, nobody mentions how much they take with them in the way of money, like the president of Afghanistan, who had to escape in a helicopter, had time to pack $179 million U.S. dollars that had been given to him to support the army. 1979, the Troubles. 18 British soldiers are killed in an ambush by the Provisional Irish Republican Army near Warren Point, Northern Ireland. That was the deadliest attack on British forces during Operation Banner. An IRA bomb also kills British royal family member Lord Mountbatten and three others on his boat in Ballaghmore, in the Republic of Ireland. 1980, a massive bomb planted by extortionist John Burgess explodes at Harvey's Resort Hotel in Stateline, Nevada. This was after a failed disarming attempt by the FBI. Although the hotel is severely damaged, no one is injured. 1982, Turkish military diplomat Colonel Attila Atakat is shot and killed in Ottawa. Justice commandos of the Armenian Genocide claim to be avenging the massacre of 1.5 million Armenians in the 1915 Armenian Genocide. Of course, they never explained why they waited 70 years to do anything about it. 1985, Nigeria's military government's overthrown by another clique of army officers. 1991, European Community recognizes the independence of the Baltic state of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. 1991, Moldova declares independence from the USSR. 2003, Mars makes its closest approach to Earth in nearly 60,000 years, passing only 34,646,418 miles away. 2003, the first six-party talks involving North and South Korea, the U.S., China, Japan, and Russia convened to find a peaceful resolution to the security concerns in the North Korean nuclear weapons program. Great waste of time for all concerned. 2006, Comair Flight 5191 crashes on takeoff from Bluegrass Airport in Lexington, Kentucky. It was bound for Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport in Atlanta. Of the passengers and crew, 49 of the 50 confirmed dead in the hours just following the crash. 2009, internal conflict in Myanmar. The Burmese military junta and the ethnic armies began 3 days of battles in the Kokang Special Region. 2011, Hurricane Irene strikes the United States East Coast, killing 47 and causing an estimated $15.6 billion in 2011 dollar damages. 2019, Barry FC becomes the first club to be expelled from the English Football League since Maidstone United in 1992. Well, there was an unbelievable number of births and deaths on this date in history. Far too many for us to go into. Holidays observances, Christian Feast Day, Baculus of Sorrento, Caesarius of Arles, Decuman, Gebhard of Constance, Euthalia, John of Pavia, Osiris, Mael Ruba or Rufus in Scotland, Margaret the Barefooted, Monica of Hippo, mother of Augustine of Hippo, Narnus, Vanurius of Rhodes, Rufus and Carpophorus, Syagrius of Autun, Thomas Gallaudet, and Henry Wintersile in the Episcopal Church. This is Film and Movie Day in Russia, Independence Day in Moldova, celebrates independence of Moldova from the USSR in 1991. Lyndon, the man who would be king, Baines Johnson Day in Texas. National Banana Lovers Day. That holiday has a great deal of appeal in the United States. National Pots to Cream Day in the United States. You have to wonder about some of these observances. Some of them just don't make any sense. All right, let's see what else we've got on this day. Well, don't you love it when the computer decides to go on strike? 479 BC, Greco-Persian Wars, Battle of Plataea. Persian forces led by Mardonius routed by the Greek army under Pausanias. Together with Greek success at the Battle of Mycale, it launched the Persian invasion of Greece. Otherwise, we might all be speaking Persian. 479 BC, also in the Greco-Persian Wars, the Battle of Mycale won by the Greek forces over the Persian naval troops on the Ionian coast. That was a double victory, you might say. 663, the Battle of Baekgang. Tang Chinese and Sino-Korean forces defeat Korean Baekje forces near Yamato, Japanese allies on the Geum River in Korea. That was the last Japanese invasion of Korea for 900 years. Yeah, let's see. I talked about Earl Mountbatten being killed when his boat blew up in 1979. He was the first Earl Mountbatten of Burma, cousin of Queen Elizabeth II, and the last Viceroy of India. He was killed with three companions, two of them children, by the IRA when they blew up his boat near Sligo in Ireland. 1950, the first transmission of a TV program from continental Europe. It was shown on the BBC. Let's see. On this date, in 2008, Barack I'm King Obama becomes the first African-American to be nominated by a major political party for President of the United States. 19, Ed Ginn was born in 1906 on this date. One of the first acknowledged serial killers. Lyndon Johnson was born in 1908. Barbara Bach was born in, she's 74 years old today. Pee Wee Herman, 68 years old. Let's see. See if there's anything else of any interest to anybody. Well, that may be Let's see. 1549, the Battle of Dusendale. John Dudley, Earl of Warwick, destroys Robert Kett's army. Then ends Kett's rebellion in Norfolk, England. 1569, Pope Pius, on the advice of God, names Cosimo I de Medici as Grand Duke of Tuscany. 1585, the Duke of Parma's troops occupy Antwerp. 1610, the Polish King Władysław crowned King of Russia. 1619, Frederick van Paltz chosen as King of Bohemia. In Java, the Sultan Agung of Mataram attacks Batavia. 1782, the Battle of Combahee River near Beaufort, North Carolina. American abolitionist John Laurens is killed while leading a charge. 1783, the first hydrogen balloon flight, it was unmanned, reaches an altitude of 900 meters. 1799, a British invasion army lands in North Holland. 1816, Lord Exmouth bombards Algiers, which had been a refuge for the Barbary pirates. 1861, the Battle of Cape Hatteras, South Carolina. Union troops take Fort Clark. 1894, Congress passed the Wilson-Gorman Tariff Act. It had a graduated income tax. Congress loves to spend your money for their silly ideas. U.S. Supreme Court struck down that tax. And of course, later on, after the Federal Reserve Act was passed, we got a temporary tax to fund World War I, but no government has ever turned down money. 1900, the Battle of Bergedal. General Butler defeats the Boers under General Louis Botha. 1913, the first aerobatic maneuver in an airplane is performed by Lieutenant Petro Nesterov of the Imperial Russian Air Service. He performed a loop in a monoplane at Kiev. 1918, the Spanish flu arrived in Boston, begins the second and deadliest wave in the U.S. It killed untold numbers of people. In fact, here, there were so many dead that the city couldn't handle them. They put in the tunnels that run underneath El Paso High School. 1938, two New York City subway trains collided at 116th Street, killed two and injured 51. 1941, the Shah of Iran, Reza Shah Pahlavi, abdicates the throne in favor of his son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. You know, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi is the last Shah of Iran. His son, trained at Fort Benning, had a huge house. 1942, Soviet woman sniper Ludmila Pavluchenko arrives in Washington, the first Soviet citizen welcomed to the White House by Eleanor Roosevelt. 1945, on this date, U.S. troops land in Japan after the Japanese surrender. 1955 was the first publication of the Guinness Book of World Records. 1 our little history segment. We have been talking in our last show about the mysterious death of Marilyn Monroe. There are many people who believe that that is or was a murder. And we're going to continue talking about that. On October 19, 1964, the FBI got a letter from a former agent who was at the time working in the office of the California governor. And he wrote that he didn't know the source and can't evaluate the authenticity of the information. But he said Robert Kennedy had been having a romance and sexual affair over a period of time with Marilyn Monroe. He said Kennedy was deeply involved emotionally with Marilyn and repeatedly promised to divorce his wife so they could marry. It also went on to say that Marilyn also had an intermittent lesbian affair. And although the name was redacted of who she was having the affair with, she admitted in tape recordings made for a psychiatrist, Ralph Greenson, that she had been having a very hot affair with actress Joan Crawford. Now, the note went on to say that Bobby Kennedy and Marilyn attended a sex party at which a tape recording was secretly made and it's in the possession of a Los Angeles private detective. And all the voices on it were identified. And then there's a series of entries regarding Marilyn's romance and marriage to playwright Arthur Miller. It seems Arthur Miller had a number of alleged communist links, and that just was enough to light J. Edgar Hoover's fuse. On September 27, 1956, it was noted that Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe married in a civil ceremony on June 29, 1956, followed by a Jewish wedding on July 1st. Went on to detail Miller's appearance before the House Committee on Un-American Activities alleged links to some 29 organizations the government believed were communist fronts. Now, there was another entry in that Marilyn Monroe file from February 15, 1965. Said that a person or persons unknown visited a New York address. Somebody exhibited a motion picture which showed Marilyn Monroe, who was dead by this time, committing a perverted act on an unknown male. Now, according to the person who showed the film, Joe DiMaggio tried to buy it from him for $25,000. And what the one copy he had was the only one in existence. But apparently the unnamed individual turned down the offer. Now, Marilyn had what was referred to as a lost weekend with Frank Sinatra. And that was, she, according to witnesses, she looked every inch the Hollywood screen siren. Dressed from head to toe in green and wearing her black sunglasses she was known for, she didn't appear to have a worry in the world. However, 24 hours later, it was reported, she fled home to Los Angeles after a scandalous stay at Lake Tahoe, Nevada. There were rumors of sex parties, mafia blackmail threats, and a drugged-out confrontation with Sinatra himself. And 6 days later, she was dead. Now, we went for a visit somewhere in Las Vegas, and they were discussing this. Apparently, at Cal Nav, which was the hotel at Lake Tahoe that Sinatra had an interest in, there were tunnels that ran to various cabins. And apparently, that last weekend, Marilyn Monroe was passed around to quite a number of people, almost like a party favor. Now, her last days in 1962 were said to be awash in a haze of booze. She started out chasing down her favorite Piper Heidsieck champagne with Bloody Marys during the day and taking handfuls of prescription pills to combat her insomnia at night. And then it went on to say pretty soon she was drinking and downing pills all during the day and night. Her failure to turn up on time or remember lines in her latest movie, the 1962 movie called Something's Gotta Give, resulted in her being fired and sued by 20th Century Fox chief Peter Levathes, when he finally lost patience with what he called her antics. Only by dint of her sheer star power and the support of Dean Martin, who rebuffed attempts to replace her with Lee Remick or Shirley MacLaine, Monroe got the part back, even negotiated a pay raise. It was to celebrate Marilyn's successful showdown with her studio bosses that Sinatra invited her to a star-studded bash at his newly opened casino hotel, the Cal Neva on Lake Tahoe. So as she struggled to keep her life from just literally unraveling, she had two people that friends said could have saved her. One was on the inside at Cal Neva. Now, Frank Sinatra was the ringmaster, entertaining the Rat Pack with friends like Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. and singer Buddy Greco. He flew Marilyn in on his private jet to the resort he'd opened just 2 weeks before with his partner, the notorious mob leader Sam Giancana, who was supposed to also have been involved in some fashion in the Kennedy's assassination. On the outside was former husband Joe DiMaggio, who flew to the casino to see Marilyn. But he wasn't allowed into the casino because he had some kind of feud going on with Sinatra. Now, there were a number of stories that Sinatra orchestrated that weekend with his mob cohorts to put the squeeze on Marilyn to not divulge any details of her romances with his friends, the Kennedys. In Donald Wolfe, in the book he wrote called The Last Days of Marilyn Monroe, claimed that the actress was involved in an orgy and was photographed in an uncompromising position so she could be blackmailed in the future if that had to be done. According to Buddy Greco, who's now living in England, when she got there that Saturday, you'd never believe she had a care in the world. He said, I was sitting with Frank, Peter Lawford, and a bunch of other folks outside Frank's bungalow when a limousine pulled up and this gorgeous woman got out. Before he realized who it was, he thought, my God, what a beautiful woman. No taste in clothes, but my God, what a beautiful woman. But later that night, the singer saw a very different Marilyn. He said the room went dark silent and still, as if somebody turned the sound off. He said, I looked at Frank, and there was no doubt he was furious. His eyes were like blue ice cubes. Looking at the door where Marilyn stood, swaying ever so slightly, she was still wearing the outfit she'd worn all day. But the woman he'd met that afternoon, smart, funny, intelligent, and fragile, was gone. She looked drunk and mad at the world, and he heard her say, who the F are they all staring at? Well, there were two documents in the FBI file entitled Marilyn and the Kennedys. They were heavily redacted, of course, and revealed details of RFK and JFK's liaisons with Marilyn. And according to what Greco told a number of people, it was clear Sinatra was worried. She was in a state where she could have said anything. Sinatra had his bodyguard get her out of there. Now, the bodyguard escorted her out. Actually, he picked her up and carried her out. And she was in such a state, she wasn't the Marilyn Monroe everybody was used to seeing. Calnav doorman reported he saw Marilyn by the pool early on Sunday morning, barefoot and swaying back and forth. She was looking up the hill at DiMaggio, who was staring down at her, half hidden in the mist that came up from the lake, and it would be the last time he saw her alive. There had been a lot of talk about them getting back together and even remarrying after she dumped her Mexican screenwriter lover, Jose Balanos, but she returned to her Brentwood home alone after Sinatra washed his hands of her. Now, I wouldn't say she didn't have plans. In fact, having taken on the Fox and won, she was once more a hot commodity in Hollywood. She could have written her own ticket. Over the next few days, she had talks on a series of projects, including a plan to make a musical version of the novel Tree Grows in Brooklyn with Sinatra himself. She was putting together a coffee table book of pictures with photographer George Barris and moving forward with a project to make a movie about her Hollywood heroine, Jean Harlow. And before the weekend, she made a date to meet up with Gene Kelly the next Monday to discuss making a film with him. Even though all this was going on, there was still no doubt in anybody's mind she was a very lonely woman. She asked one Los Angeles reporter in what seemed to be an unscripted response, do you know who I've always depended on? No strangers, not friends, the telephone. That's my best friend. I love calling friends, especially late at night when I can't sleep. And nobody she talked to that weekend said she sounded particularly depressed or upset. On the morning of Saturday, August 4th, 1962, handyman Norman Jeffries was busy working on the floor of Marilyn's home when he looked up to see her standing there wrapped in a giant bath towel. He told Anthony Summers, the biographer, I'll never forget that sight. She looked sick, desperately sick, not only in the physical sense. There had to be something wrong. She must have taken a lot of dope or something, or maybe she was just scared. Marilyn's press agent, Major Domo Pat Newcomb, had stayed the night and recalled the actress was in an irritable mood. She was particularly annoyed because Newcomb had slept for 15 hours straight while she, again, had trouble going to sleep at all. In her last months, it was reported she suffered night terrors and would have to get up and sit in a chair until the dark cloud lifted. Psychiatrist Dr. Ralph Greenson was called over to the house and immediately noticed she appeared to be heavily sedated. Now, he had made a number of attempts to break his patient's reliance on Nembutal barbiturates in favor of chloral hydrate as a sleep aid. He stayed until about 7 p.m. before he went to dinner. At 7:15, it was reported she appeared to be in good spirits when she talked on the phone with Joe DiMaggio Jr. about his recent decision to end his engagement. 30 minutes later, it was apparent there was another 180-degree mood change. Actor friend Peter Lawford had been badgering her to go down to the beach for a party that night. But when he spoke to her on the phone, he said she sounded out of it. He had to shout her name into the handset several times before she would respond. She told him, according to what biographer Donald Spoto said, she told Lawford to say goodbye to Pat, that was Lawford's wife, say goodbye to the president, goodbye to yourself because you're a nice guy. Now, there have been a number of theories over what happened in the hours that followed in that small house, the first Marilyn actually ever owned. But one fact is indisputable. She didn't make it through the night. Sergeant Jack Clemens was serving as acting watch commander in West Los Angeles when his desk telephone rang at about 4:25 in the morning, August 5, 1962. And an unidentified caller said one sentence before hanging up. Marilyn Monroe is dead. She committed suicide. Now, because it was a slow night, he decided to investigate himself and arrived at Monroe's bedroom on Helena Drive in Brentwood about 10 minutes later. Found her lying face down on the bed, her shoulders exposed, but a sheet pulled up over her lifeless body. Now, if you're going to commit suicide, why do you cover yourself up? Why would you care? Whatever the real reason was for her death, there was no doubt there was a cover-up, and there were so many lies that even the perpetrators couldn't keep up with the stories they were telling. According to biographer Donald Spoto, Marilyn's housekeeper, Eunice Murray, tells Sergeant Clemens she first discovered her employer's body at midnight. Then later on, she changed the story to say 3 a.m. She was also busy doing the laundry in the middle of the night when the police arrived, suggesting somebody had something to hide, although she was never asked who it was or why they were had anything to hide or why she was doing the laundry at 3 in the morning. Now, Murray was hired by Marilyn the previous year at the instigation of Greenson. The actress suspected her employee was told to spy on her for the shrink. And Greenson did make a point to keep in very close contact with his star patient. It was Murray who called Greenson to the house saying she saw a light still on in Marilyn's bedroom late at night, which was apparently very unusual. She was afraid to wake her up, so she called the psychiatrist. Doctor ordered the housekeeper to knock on the door. When she couldn't get a reply, Greenson told Murray to call Marilyn's internist, Hyman Engelberg, and said he was heading over to it from his home, which was a mile and a half away. Both doctors and Murray were at the house when Sergeant Clemens arrived. Officer wasn't happy with their explanation they wanted for before calling for help because it needed permission from 20th Century Fox's publicity department, which I think is very odd, even in those golden days of the powerful Hollywood studios. That was a hard idea to follow. That jeopardized the health of their star property. Now, there were a number of reports of other strange goings-on that night, which came to light. Breaking glass and raised voices are heard coming from Marilyn's house by a neighbor. There was an ambulance supposedly parked outside, and a helicopter hovered overhead earlier on that Saturday night. The voice of a hysterical woman who was never identified was heard screaming, "Murderers, you murderers! You satisfied now she's dead?" Well, on the weekend she died, Bobby Kennedy, who was Attorney General at the time, was staying at the Northern California ranch owned by wealthy attorney John Bates, about 60 miles from San Francisco. He was due to give a speech at the California Bar Association, and Bates, of course, was his host. Now, Bobby Kennedy's representatives always insisted that was where he remained the entire time. He was seen at church there on the morning after the tragedy as the world woke up to find out that Marilyn Monroe was dead. But biographer Matthew Smith insisted that Bobby Kennedy was told to get your ass down to L.A. because she's out of control. After Marilyn let slip to some confidants, she was planning to hold a Monday morning press conference where she'd blow the lid off the whole damn thing. Now, exactly what she planned to say, if anything, was never revealed, but there was a long rumored to be a red diary in which Marilyn would jot down secrets JFK and Bobby whispered to her during their pillow talk. According to some biographers, it was this notebook Bobby's trying to get when he allegedly made two trips to see Marilyn in the hours before she died. One neighbor by the name of Betty Pollard said her mother was playing bridge with a friend when they noticed Kennedy going into Marilyn's house sometime before 5 p.m. Smith claims that Bobby returned several hours later and lost his temper with Marilyn after demanding she hand over the diary. Deborah Gould, an ex-wife of actor Peter Lawford, told Anthony Summers the real reason for the delay in reporting the death to the police was to get Bobby out of town. She wasn't necessarily accusing Bobby Kennedy of foul play. However, that thought did come to everybody's mind. Summers puts a different spin on Kennedy's alleged visit to see Marilyn. He suggested she may well have been at the house because he was generally concerned for her health after she made that rambling call to Lawford. That was the Kennedy's brother-in-law through his first wife, Patricia. According to this more sympathetic theory, Bobby may have rushed over to Marilyn's house only to find her dead and dying, leaving him with a difficult dilemma. Even had he never had an affair with Marilyn, and all the evidence points to the fact that he did, for Kennedy to be found with a dead Marilyn Monroe, even on a legitimate mission of mercy, would have been a political disaster. Marilyn wrote about all this in his 1985 biography, Goddess, The Secret Lives of Marilyn Monroe. So if her death was not an accident, or by her own hand, who might have wanted Marilyn Monroe dead? And who did the deed? Now, Teamster boss Jimmy Hoffa certainly hated the Kennedys and reportedly thought he'd either blackmail or shame the family by sending mob enforcers to kill Marilyn and implicate them in the murder. There's another possibility, equally as valid. Certain government agencies, such as the CIA or Secret Service, may have been so concerned at what Marilyn may have gotten through her relationship with the Kennedy brothers that when she threatened to expose them, she became too much of a risk to leave alive. And of course, there were more questions after the autopsy by Dr. Thomas Noguchi than working in the L.A. Medical Examiner's office. Police investigators already questioned why there was no water glass near Marilyn if she'd swallowed as many as 30, 40 pills, and Dr. Noguchi himself was wondering why her stomach was empty if she had ingested that many capsules. And if she'd taken an overdose of Nimbitol barbiturates, as the toxicology reports pointed to, there should have been a telltale yellow dye in the linings of her throat, esophagus, and stomach. There was no such stain. So there are many who question whether or not she took anything. Experts claim the only likely answer was that Marilyn had taken or been forcibly given the lethally large dose via an enema. Former L.A. Deputy District Attorney John Miner, 30 years later, said, "I didn't think she committed suicide." He was present at the autopsy and added that his inquiry showed that Marilyn was making plans for the future, and she felt she had put everything bad behind her, could now go forward with her life. Many of her friends went one step further. Photographer George Barris, who took the famous pictures of Marilyn and served her last summer and spoke to her on the phone the day before she died, said in his book, "Always been my conviction she was murdered." Now, the lack of any definite conclusions about the coroner and the question marks, contradictions, and suspicious behavior of almost all the main players make it virtually impossible to believe that there wasn't a cover-up at some point. From there, it wasn't a big leap to think whoever's responsible for her death got away with murder. Now, 10 years before she died, during the heady early days of her rise to fame, she made a special request of her makeup artist friend, Alan Whitey Snyder. She said, "Promise me if something happens to me, you do my makeup so I look my best when I leave." August 7, 1962, Joe DiMaggio called in that favor. He asked the makeup artist, "Will you do it, please, for her?" Makeup artist told him before driving to the Westwood Village mortuary that he would, in fact, do Marilyn's makeup one more time. It was DiMaggio who decided he wasn't going to turn his former wife's funeral into the kind of celebrity circus that had undoubtedly led to her death. Sinatra wasn't invited, neither was Dean Martin or Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, any of the Rat Pack. They were all left out. According to one witness, Sinatra was so determined to be president, he brought his own security people to pretend they were working there and help slip him in, but that didn't work. Only 30 relatives and close friends watched Marilyn's final chapter play out in the mortuary chapel, while hundreds of photographers, reporters, and fans waited outside. Marilyn's longtime acting teacher, Lee Strasberg, gave a eulogy, and a pastor offered a brief address. And her favorite song, "Over the Rainbow," was piped in. Before the casket was closed, it was reported a weeping DiMaggio kissed Marilyn a final goodbye. He put a posy of roses in her dead hands. Although their marriage had ended, DiMaggio and Marilyn had been seeing each other again in the months before her death, and on August 1st, 62, the retired slugger confided to pals he'd proposed to his ex-wife again, and she'd agreed to marry him. Just one major thorn in his battle to win back the actress, the shadowy figure of Bobby Kennedy. DiMaggio still had friends among Marilyn's closest confidants, and he would have been painfully aware of her clandestine affair with the Attorney General. He would also have understood all too well the truth that Marilyn never closed her eyes to the fact Bobby would never leave Ethel and her children. To a proud, possessive Sicilian like DiMaggio, the way the Kennedys toyed with Marilyn's emotions certainly made his blood boil, particularly as he was chasing her himself. And according to the FBI file, the last call Marilyn took on the night she died was from her ex-husband's son, Joe DiMaggio Jr. He was in the Marines stationed at Camp Pendleton near San Diego. According to what the file said, they were very friendly in that conversation. Well, that's interesting. This day and time, if it's not car warranties, it's solar panels. We get inundated. On a line it's not supposed to be given out. Well, as I said, Marilyn's last call, according to the FBI, was with her ex-husband's son, Joe DiMaggio Jr. And Marilyn, in that call, told him she was getting sleepy. Now, Joe DiMaggio Sr. knew the whole story, and it's reported to have stated when Robert Kennedy gets out of office, he's going to kill him. Also, the FBI file also said Joe DiMaggio Jr. knew of the affair between Robert Kennedy and Marilyn. With everyone else, at any other time, this death threat alone would have been enough to send major alarm bells ringing right up to the very top, but DiMaggio hadn't made much of a secret of his disdain for Bobby, and hours later, he's grieving the loss of what he called the great love of his life. Of course, DiMaggio had never made good on his threat, but he didn't let go of his memories of Marilyn so easily. He never married again. 3 times a week for the next 20 years, he delivered fresh flowers to her grave. When he died in 1999, his last words reportedly were, "I'll finally get to see Marilyn." Other than its color, it's not an ostentatious last resting place. The pink marble wall on Crypt 24 at the Corridor of Memories in Los Angeles has a bronze plaque that says Marilyn Monroe, 1926 to 1962. There was no trace left of the Norma Jean. No sign of the vulnerable lost girl who was overtaken by stardom that rolled over her old life so fast she could never quite keep up. But more than 50 years after her mysterious death, there's simply too many questions that remain unanswered for Marilyn Monroe to rest in peace. It might be interesting for us to review a timeline of what happened on the night of August 4th, 1962. At 7:15 p.m., Marilyn sounded cheerful and upbeat on the phone with Joe DiMaggio Jr. He recalls the time because he is watching the seventh inning of a Baltimore Orioles baseball tie with the Los Angeles Dodgers, and the time matches with the game record. At 7:30, Peter Lawford calls Marilyn to invite her to his house, but she declines. According to Lawford, her speech was slurred and hard to decipher. Then the call just ended, and the line remained busy when Lawford tried to reconnect. At 8 p.m., Lawford reports he called Marilyn's housekeeper, Eunice Murray, and asked her to check on Marilyn. Murray says Marilyn's fine. At 10:30 that evening, Marilyn's agent, Arthur Jacobs, leaves a concert at the Hollywood Bowl after being told by the actress's lawyer, Mickey Rudin, that the actress had overdosed. At midnight, Eunice Murray, never explained why she was up at that time, noticed a light under Marilyn's door and couldn't get a response after knocking, so she telephoned psychiatrist Dr. Ralph Greenson. At 12:30 a.m. on August 5th, Greenson arrives, looks through the French windows and sees Marilyn lying lifeless on her bed holding a telephone. He broke the glass, he said, to open the locked door and discover she was dead, so he calls her physician, Dr. Hyman Engelberg. 1 a.m., Lawford is told by Rudin, the attorney, that Marilyn is dead. Now, the next entry in the timeline was over 3 hours later. At 4:25 a.m., an emergency call to police reporting Marilyn's death. 4:35, police arrive at Marilyn's house. 5:40 a.m., Undertaker Gary Hockett arrives at the scene, puts the time of death as between 9:30 and 11:30 p.m. the night before. Now, to try to cover up that missing 3 hours, at 6, Murray changes her story to police and says she called Greenson after waking around 3 and seeing Marilyn's light still on. Greenson and Engelbert now claims the time of death was about 3:50 in the morning, not the night before. So you got to ask yourself, what went on during the missing 3 hours? Were they looking for the mysterious diary? Well, there's a secret recording. I guess you could call it a secret recording. It was called Marilyn Monroe Uncensored. It revealed the most intimate secrets of the famous sex symbol. Dressed only in her underwear, Marilyn made this tape in the privacy of her bedroom as an extraordinary experiment for her personal psychiatrist, Ralph Greenson. Supposed to be for his ears only. And in fact, for the next 40 years, it did remain under wraps. When the tapes finally emerged, they threw fresh doubts on the official suicide theory about her death and fueled conspiracy theorists, though convinced the death was more sinister. In that tape, she bared her innermost thoughts and emotions in a way few celebrities have ever done, especially at a time when the public images of the stars are so tightly controlled by the studios. She talked about Jack and Bobby Kennedy, about her marriages and why they failed, about her sexual problems and the other men and women in her life. As she put it herself, they were the most private, the most secret thoughts of Marilyn Monroe. Even more intriguing in this tape, she talked about her excitement about her plans for the future. She sounded bright and insightful and brimming with ideas about the next phase of her life. She complained about her nosy housekeeper and talked about her plan to fire her. Hardly the mindset of a star that was getting ready to commit suicide. The implication is either her death was an accident or she was murdered. The reason the tape remained buried for so long was because Marilyn gave him confidence to Dr. Greenson. Maybe on the actual morning of her death, or at least a day or so before. She was said to have told him, "I have absolute confidence and trust. You'll never reveal to a living soul what I say to you." In fact, the only person he actually played him for was Los Angeles Deputy District Attorney John Miner, who in turn promised to keep him private to preserve the doctor-patient privilege. Now, I would point out to you, legally, the doctor-patient privilege ends when the patient dies. Psychiatrist wouldn't allow Miner to take the tape, but he did permit him to take extensive and nearly verbatim notes. It wasn't until 20 years after Dr. Greenson's own death that Miner disclosed what was in the tapes in a belated effort to try to set the record straight on some key factors surrounding the mysterious death of Marilyn Monroe. He unrevealed the contents then because he was concerned that Dr. Greenson's reputation had been maligned over the years with suggestions his treatment over prescription of drugs had somehow led to Monroe's suicide. Whatever her emotional state was at the time, she made the tapes as a way of helping her deal with the insecurities that still plagued her despite her immense wealth and fame. In his 2004 book, Marilyn's Last Words, Her Secret Tapes and Mysterious Death, writer Matthew Smith made the contents of the homemade recordings public for the first time. And they do make fascinating reading. She even talked about her sex life, and she made a surprising confession. She said, "What I told you is true. When I first became your patient, I'd never had an orgasm. I well remember you said an orgasm happens in the mind, not the genitals. You said there was an obstacle in my mind and prevented me from having an orgasm. And it was something that happened early in my life by which I felt so guilty I didn't deserve to have the greatest pleasure there is. I'd win overwhelmingly if the Academy gave the Oscar for fake orgasms. I've done some of my best acting convincing my partner I was actually having a great time." She also said she stood naked in front of her full-length mirrors for a long time yesterday and was all made up with my hair done. And she said, "What did I see? My breasts are beginning to sag. My waist isn't bad. My ass is what it should be, the best there is. Legs, knees, and ankles still shapely. Feet not too big." She also talked about her father fixation with Clark Gable, her co-star in the 1961's The Misfits. She said, "In the kissing scenes, I kissed him with real affection. I didn't want to go to bed with him, but I wanted him to know how much I liked and appreciated him. On her dream role, I dreamt that I was sitting on Clark Gable's lap with his arms around me. He said, 'They want me to do Gone with the Wind sequel. And I will if you'll be my Scarlet.'" Well, she went into quite a bit of detail in these tapes and talked about the future, which she really wouldn't have done if she was going to end it a short time later. For more than half a century, the idea that a depressed Marilyn Monroe died naked and alone in her bed after taking a massive overdose of drugs has become an iconic pop culture touchstone. But one thing is clear right now. The Los Angeles Medical Examiner's 1963 report was wrong. It was not suicide. Put simply, nothing adds up to support the official cause of death. It's not a question whether Marilyn was murdered or by whom. Friends said she was happy and looking forward to the future with an optimism and zest she'd been missing for some months. There was no suicide note, no evidence in her stomach she'd swallowed 40 or 50 missing Nimbitol sleeping pills, as many as 17 chloronitrate pills. And there were major gaps in the timeline of the events. And the scene had been swept as clean as a whistle. But the actress could never have anticipated, as she settled down for the night, was it the powerful forces marshaled against her. Only at the very last minute would she have realized her life was in jeopardy. So much is suspicious about the death of Monroe, but the investigation of what really happened to the doomed actress really never got off the ground. The medical examiner who carried out the autopsy on Marilyn's body, Thomas Noguchi, offered at the time a cause of death as probable suicide, but over the years, even he began to doubt it. Now, he also said the embalmed body is that of a 36-year-old, well-developed, well-nourished Caucasian female weighing 117 pounds. The scalp is covered with bleach blonde hair. The eyes are blue. There's a slight bleeding under the skin noted on the left hip and the lower side of the lower back. Later on, he said this could have indicated violence. He qualified his comment by adding that he would have expected to find fresh bruises around the throat or skull if there had been foul play. But nevertheless, in his memoir, entitled Coroner, 1983, said that fresh bruise on her hip still remains unexplained. It's curious, most of the investigative reporters who later became interested in the case failed to pick it up. Then the question becomes, who would have killed Marilyn? Well, Bobby Kennedy had a reason to do it. John Kennedy had a reason to order it. Even J. Edgar Hoover, to keep his hold over the Kennedys. Well, even Private Eye Fred Otash, the investigator who knew where all the bodies were buried in Hollywood in the 50s and 60s, had been asked by Marilyn herself to help her record her calls, but at the same time, he surreptitiously hid bugs on Peter Lawford to keep tabs on it for the Kennedys. Why were the Kennedys so concerned? Bernie Spindell, a freelance operator who counted MobLink Teamster boss Jimmy Hoffa as one of his customers, had installed another set of wiretaps. Her house was more wired than a recording studio. To the Kennedys, Marilyn was a potential embarrassment, needed to be handled carefully. To the Mafia, she was the Achilles heel they could use to get to their archenemies in Washington. And as I said, there was a third element involved in this conspiracy. J. Edgar Hoover. He had a reason to fear the Kennedys, who were trying to force him out of the fiefdom he had built the agency into through his years in charge. Now, neither recording has ever been made public, but accounts on both sides appear to mesh. There's no doubt that Otash, according to a note written by the investigator, he listened to Marilyn die after he taped an argument she had with Bobby Kennedy and Peter Lawford. She was passed around. She said she was passed around like a piece of meat. It was a violent argument about their relationship and the commitment and promises he made. She was screaming. They were trying to quiet her down. She's in the bedroom. Bobby gets a pillow and he muffles her on the bed to keep the neighbors from hearing. She's finally quieted down. Well, that ends our segment on Marilyn Monroe. There was no doubt in my mind that she was murdered, and I've got a book coming out called Loose Ends, where I talk about several high-profile murders. Until tomorrow, well, actually, this is Friday, so until Monday, this is Ken Hudnall for The Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great weekend.